As you set up this book, you note that King is often put up on a pedestal. He's kind of a secular saint. What do we miss when that's the primary lens that we view him through?
Well, we miss his humanity for one thing. We miss the fact that he sacrificed and that he suffered and that this wasn't always easy for him and that he made mistakes. He was flawed. And I think as a result of that, we tend to treat him almost like this mythological figure. And I wanted to write a book that would sort of restore his sense of humanity and remind people that he lived and breathed and felt pain and felt a great sense of accomplishment, and that it wasn't preordained, that he was making stuff up as he went along and he was struggling.
Tell me more about that humanity. What are the flaws that you think often get sort of pushed aside?
In turning him into a national holiday and a national monument, which are things that he clearly deserved, we've also turned him into this sort of two-dimensional figure, and we forget that he chewed his fingernails, he smoked cigarettes, he tried to hide it from his kids. And on the larger scale, he was afraid of conflict in many ways. He really did. It's just a funny thing to say for a protest leader who makes his living sort of driving a wedge between people who are uncomfortable advancing the cause of justice and those who are pushing for justice. He also had deeper flaws as a human being, things like marital fidelity. And he recognized his own flaws and he didn't want to be treated as a saint.
Plenty has been written about King, but as you wrote this book, you had access to materials that were new. What were some of those?
Well, the most obvious new materials that I knew going into it that I would find were the FBI documents that have been declassified in the last 50, 60 years, and many of them declassified even in just the last few years, long since the last round of biographies of King. And a lot of those FBI documents get into the personal life of King, because that was J. Edgar Hoover's obsession. Really trying to damage King by revealing his personal flaws. So that was one thing. But I also found things like an unpublished autobiography that King's father wrote. I found tapes that Coretta made when she was working on her first memoir just months after her husband's assassination. And I found the archival documents collected by the official historian of the SCLC, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, thousands and thousands of pages that kept notes on every meeting, on every church session, on every song that was sung at these rallies. And this archivist for the SCLC traveled with King all the time. So that was a gold mine.
What sort of things did they reveal that we didn't know before?
Well, on the FBI front, what they mostly reveal, we get a few more details about the women that King was having relationships with. But most importantly, they reveal the degree to which the FBI weaponized King's personal life to try to destroy him, and the degree to which President Lyndon Johnson was complicit in that. He not only knew exactly what the FBI was doing, he was encouraging it. And he seemed to actually enjoy the gossipy details of King's life. And I believe LBJ had the power to shut it down. And he clearly recognized that King was not affiliated with communists. There was really no point in wiretapping except to gain this sense of control, to have this feeling that I've got the goods on him. Is that enough to damage and destroy a relationship between, one of the greatest relationships ever, maybe the greatest relationship ever between a president and a protest leader? And I think LBJ bears a lot of the responsibility for blowing up that relationship.
Well, I want to move to Birmingham in 1963. And you note that when King was invited to the city by the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, initially, at least, this mass movement was not mass and it was not a movement. Why was that?
When King had this great success in Montgomery and really thrilled the nation with the possibility of a nationwide movement that would repeat the magic of Montgomery, he had a hard time duplicating it. King did not have a grand national strategy. This was not, a big rollout with consulting companies, helping to prepare the model. And he went to places like, St. Augustine and really did not fare very well. He found that it was hard to get traction. It was hard to get cooperation, and it was hard to really focus the nation's attention on the issue, because in Montgomery it was crystal clear: we're trying to integrate the buses, and you have this dramatic scene of thousands of people walking every day to their jobs, and it was very easy to see what they were asking for. But when he went to places like St. Augustine and Albany, Georgia, it wasn't clear what he was asking for, and the protests kind of fell apart. And when he came to Birmingham, they were determined not to repeat that same failure. They were determined to be more specific, and they focused more on economic demands, that they wanted the city to rethink the way it was treating African-American people in terms of their jobs, in terms of access to stores. Always the goal with King was to create conflict, but they still didn't know how they were going to do it exactly. And it didn't go that well, actually, in the beginning when King arrived in Birmingham.
We know the Birmingham movement led to the Children's March, which had great impact on the civil rights movement. But how did we get to what it became?
Right. And a lot of people didn't want or thought it was wrong to bring in the children, that it was a desperation move and that it was dangerous, which it truly was. When King arrived in Birmingham, a lot of the Black preachers were not on board. They were reluctant to get involved. He found it hard to coalesce support. Of course, now Bull Connor has this reputation as being this brutal law enforcement leader who sicked the dogs. But he was actually showing restraint for a little while, and that was making it difficult. It wasn't until the dogs got loose that people began to think that they were commanding enough national attention that they might actually have a movement on their hands. And it wasn't until King desperately really agreed to allow the students to become the heart. And that was because they couldn't find enough people to march. So that tells you something about how much he was struggling to gain traction in the city.
Well, nevertheless, the march did come through. A year later, he gets a Nobel Peace Prize. You write that roughly this time period is when he's at the height of his influence. What was it about that time period that made him so influential compared to other parts of his life?
You know, I think in 1963, coming off of Birmingham and leading into the March on Washington, there's this sense, at least in the North, maybe a more reluctant sense in the South, that change was really going to happen and that America was turning a corner. There was a feeling that we really might be able to put some of this anger and violence behind us. And the March on Washington really represented that for so many people, literally Black and white people together harmonizing and singing along and hearing these inspirational words. And we come out of that march with the feeling that, like, you know, JFK, who was opposed to the march, is now ready to really help push for meaningful civil rights legislation. There's a feeling that this could be it, and that King is really poised to lead, to unite. And part of the reason he has this power is that his voice really carries across racial dividing lines, even somewhat between North and South. You know, there are even some white leaders in the South who are beginning to think that it's time to acknowledge that we have to change things. Unfortunately, it doesn't last. You know, there's a backlash to this success. We see it, you know, just days after the March on Washington, when the bombing of the church in Birmingham.
When you think about the larger arc of King's life, what was the significance of Birmingham within that larger story?
Well, I think Birmingham is in many ways his greatest victory, in that it really focuses the nation's attention. It really leads to the greatest legislative accomplishment of his career and LBJ's career. From there on, it's really an attempt to replicate that. You know, how can he travel elsewhere, and especially in the North? Is there a way to bring the same kind of national attention to Northern racism that he did in Birmingham? And often his advisors say it's not going to work because you don't have Bull Connor, because you don't have, part of it is hypocritical, really, because the Northern media is never going to respond as fervently to complaints about Chicago racism as they are going to respond to complaints about Birmingham racism. So King is kind of in a bind in that way.
Well, I did want to ask a little bit about Coretta Scott King, his wife, because while the two of them met in Boston when he was doing graduate work at Boston University, she was from rural Alabama, Marion, Alabama. And how did you see her roots, her background influence him?
Coretta is a great story. And, you know, she comes out of Marion. She goes to a special school, the Lincoln School in Marion, where Black and white educators are teaching her. She has this incredible opportunity. And then she gets funding from the government, the state government of Alabama, to study in the North. So she goes to Antioch College and then goes to Boston to study music. She comes back really radicalized by this. Before she meets Martin Luther King, she is an activist. She's involved in protests on campus. And I think that one of the things that really attracted Martin Luther King to Coretta is the fact that she had more experience as an activist when they met. And she is not really excited about coming back down South. I think she would have preferred to stay up North, where she might have had a chance of doing something with her musical skills. But she accepts her husband's desire to return to the South, to Montgomery first, and then to Atlanta. because that's where he wants to be a minister. But it's a compromise for her, and she's forever compromising, really. She doesn't get to be the activist that she wanted to be.
Yeah, and that kind of gets to my next question, because it was interesting to me to learn that despite being a champion of racial justice, King was not particularly progressive on women, either professionally or within his marriage. What accounts for that?
A lot of it is simply a matter of the age in which he's born and also the conditions into which he's born, which is, you know, Southern Baptist ministers are not known for their progressiveness when it comes to women in roles of leadership. And people like, you know, Ella Baker complained all the time that it was impossible to get respect. It was impossible to promote women in positions of leadership within the SCLC because it was run by a bunch of Southern Baptist ministers who just didn't appreciate the contributions of women. And God knows King was hearing it from his wife, and he respected his wife and really you know, admired her for her intelligence. And he often said that, you know, she taught me about activism, but it didn't translate into really letting the women have meaningful roles of leadership.
One of the themes that you weave throughout this book is what makes King unique, sort of why him, why was he the symbol of this movement? With all the reading, all the work that you've done, have you settled on an answer to that question?
A lot of it has to do with the voice. This is not just beautiful. It doesn't just ring with these majestic tones. It sounds both radical and moderate at the same time. He's a preacher. He's preaching the words of God from the Bible, something we most of us in America can connect with. And he's using the themes of the Constitution, of American democracy, of patriotism, to say Black people in America have been mistreated. They've been scorned. They've been rebuked. But they're not asking to tear down American society. They're asking to join it. And it's very hard to argue with such a loving, positive, patriotic view. So King's voice, it speaks to the Black people of the South, speaks to rich white people in the North who want to contribute, and even begins to pierce the armor of some of the white Southern segregationists who are opposed to him, because for all its radicalness, it's also rational and seemingly reasonable.
Jonathan Eig is the author of King, A Life. The biography is out today. Jonathan, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.